Today's presenting sponsor is SimpliSafe Home Security. You can't fix our political system with a snap of your fingers, but you can fix the feeling that your home isn't as safe as it should be. With SimpliSafe, protecting your home can feel almost as easy as a snap of your fingers. John Lovett set up a SimpliSafe just with a snap of his fingers.
Yeah.
Now he's snapping all the time.
Can't stop snapping. Really easy to do. You can customize it and then set it up. The app is really great. The customer support is really reliable. It gives you peace of mind. I recommend it.
It's real security, SimpliSafe, because it acts before the break-in. It's built to help stop crimes before they start. Instead of waiting, SimpliSafe works outside with a double layer of defense. They got the AI-powered cameras that notice when someone's lurking and live agents that speak in real time so the person knows they're on camera, and if they don't leave, police can be on their way. That's proactive protection, no contracts, and it was named Best Home Security of 2025 by U.S. News & World Report. 60-day money-back guarantee so you can try it and see the difference for yourself. This month only. Take 50% off any new system. This is one of the best prices you will ever see for SimpliSafe. Don't miss it. Hit simplisafe.com/crooked. Again, that's simplisafe.com/crooked and lock in your discount. There's no safe like SimpliSafe.
MS Now's Rachel Maddow tells the story of one of the most shocking decisions in American history in her new original podcast, Rachel Maddow Presents Burn Order. This six-part series reveals how an executive order authorizing the roundup of innocent Americans came to be and a bombshell discovery in the unlikeliest of places that would ultimately expose it all. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Pod Save America. I'm Jon Favreau.
I'm John Lovett.
I'm Tommy Vitor.
On today's show, we'll talk about how Republicans are about to let your healthcare premiums double or triple, and what Trump has decided to do about all the economic harm he's inflicted. We'll also get into the politics of the next big media merger between Netflix and Warner Brothers Discovery, where Trump has, of course, inserted himself. Then we'll hear Lovett's interview with Bloomberg's Lucas Shaw, who reported out the story of Netflix buying Warners and why it matters. But let's start with this week's big push from the White House on the issue Trump calls a con job and a hoax, affordability. Even though the administration has been trying their best to keep potentially bad economic news to themselves, they just announced the report on a key measure of inflation will be delayed until next month. The data we do have hasn't been great. Consumer sentiment is down 28% from last December. Big retailers keep warning that they're about to increase prices because they can't continue to absorb the costs of Trump's tariffs. Private companies cut 32,000 jobs last month, led by small businesses, which can't absorb the cost of tariffs, as well as big companies. Total layoffs this year topped 1.1 million, the highest since 2020 in the pandemic. And another pandemic-era phrase has returned this holiday season: K-shaped economy, where the richest people are doing great, but those with lower incomes are not. Trump's preferred strategy to deal with this, of course, is to just keep denying reality. But it seems like some combination of his advisors and nervous Republicans in Congress have convinced him to at least try pretending he cares. He issued an executive order last week to develop a task force to investigate potential price fixing in imported food. The report is due in just 6 months. and on Monday, he announced a $12 billion bailout paid for by all of us for farmers who are struggling because of Trump's tariffs, which are also being paid for by all of us. Here's Trump at that event.
You know, Biden made none. He didn't make any trade deals having to do with the farmers or any of it. It's crazy. China committed. He was the worst president in the history of our country, by the way, in case anybody has any questions. We inherited a mess. Democrats caused the affordability problem. They have a tendency to just say this election's based on affordability, and nobody questions them, John. You know, nobody says, "Oh, well, what do you mean by that?" They just say the word. They never say anything else because they caused the problem. But we're fixing the problem.
I wonder why nobody says, "What do you mean by that?" Is it because they're not fucking idiots?
Well, it's also
what does the word affordability mean?
It's funny too that it's that there's two things going on at once, which is that costs have never been lower and the economy is completely fucked up because of the Democrats. Like, you just sort of, those are the two things happening at the same time.
Trump's also heading to Pennsylvania on Tuesday for the first big economic speech of his nationwide affordability blitz, which I can only assume he'll treat with the kind of message discipline he's known for. You think we'll see a lot of these events? You think he'll stick to the script?
I'm excited to watch.
It's funny that we're back. It's such a normal thing. It's like, we got to do a fucking tour. You got to go out. We're going to do an affordability tour. We're going to put the word affordability behind you. It's like the most old school, normal political reaction from a White House.
No way the word affordability is behind him, right? Because he's called it a con job. He's going to call it like...
It's going to be like best economy ever. It's going to be like aspirational marketing.
Or like working class tax cuts.
Yeah, exactly.
That's the new name for the stupid bill.
Mm-hmm.
So do we think that farmers will be appropriately grateful to the president for easing the pain he continues to inflict on them?
Potentially. I mean, this is just the completely predictable outcome of this trade war. It happened in the first term. Remember, he slapped a bunch of tariffs on China. Then he had to give U.S. farmers a bailout, and it's happening again. But this time it's worse because the Chinese were better prepared. They'd already built these relationships with farmers in Argentina and Brazil. They bought soybeans from them. They didn't buy them from the U.S. farmers, which devastated American soybean farmers. I talked about this with Rob Sand, who's running for governor of Iowa, in the episode before Thanksgiving. And Trump is claiming that the Chinese are going to buy $12 billion worth of American soybeans, but it hasn't happened yet. Either way, it has completely screwed up the ability of these farmers to like plan, manage crops, do all the things they need to do. So I just want to tell you some stats, though, guys. Meanwhile, over in China, in the first 11 months of this year, China's exports increased by 5.4%. That's $3.4 trillion in exports. And they have a trade surplus of over $1 trillion. Even with an average U.S. tariff of 37%. So exports to the U.S. are down close to 29% from the year before. So the Chinese sold more to Africa, Southeast Asia, Latin America. What a surprise. So maybe this cycle of like bankrupting American farmers and then paying them off will work again. My guess is ultimately these farmers would rather just like run a business and not deal with this shit. But
making China great again.
We'll see. Yeah.
That's $1 trillion doing.
Trade surplus.
The bailout also is a fraction of what his policies have cost farmers. One estimate put it at around $44 billion for this year. And I want to imagine what it would be like if there was a Democratic policy to tax an industry into oblivion and then send a check for roughly a third or a quarter of that amount to the people impacted, and what Republicans would do with that mix of protectionism and winner
stupidity, choosing.
Yeah, and idiocy.
And Trump said it himself. He said, at that event, he goes, this money would not be possible without tariffs. Because of tariffs, this is possible. Yes, we know.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's that's the whole problem.
And part of, I would say, like, to me, my bigger question in all of this is, like, why isn't there more political fallout among farmers in this moment, and like more of an effort to figure out how to build like support for Democratic candidates or Democratic policies in these states? Because this is ridiculous. I mean, these are people that are being decimated. The amount Trump is going to send as a bailout is no match for the cost that he's incurring on their economies. And we will also, and then someone like Rob Sand, who's a great candidate, will struggle as hard as possible to overcome the disadvantage of being a Democrat running in a state as red as Iowa.
I will say I did an event last month with one House candidate from Iowa and from Wisconsin, and they were saying it's all they hear everywhere.
Yeah,
from farmers and people in rural America.
There's a lot of consolidation in these big agribusinesses that ultimately probably like tax cuts and deregulation in other places. But yeah, it's terrible.
Yeah, better way to maybe say it is like, how can we turn this into an opportunity? Yeah.
The other challenge with doing it this way, aside from it just being stupid to slap tariffs on people that hurt them, and then use taxpayer dollars to to help
undo some of the
defray
pain.
Some of the pain.
It's punching someone in the face and then giving them an Advil.
Is the way that they're the program is going through this like bridge program at USDA, the Agriculture Department. And when they did this in the first term, because I think he gave $20 billion back in the first term, independent analysis from the New York Times found that the payments that they made disproportionately went to the largest and wealthiest farms.
Absolutely.
So it's not really, there's no good way to target the bailout to the people that are being hurt worst by the tariffs.
Right.
Which is a real fucking problem.
We love our farmers, though.
One of those larger and wealthier farms might belong to a soybean farmer, Scott Bessent, who's somehow still out there saying this. This is from the Sunday shows.
I'm involved in the agriculture industry. I run a soybean farm, and I can tell you.
You own one. You invest in it.
Sorry?
You own or invest
in
it.
And people in my
farm.
Family go out and work on it. I actually just divested it this week as part of my ethics agreement, so I'm out of that business.
People in his family. You think we're going third, fourth cousins? What do you think?
he Botox his personality? Like, that dude, yeah, that makes cadavers look loose.
He's really gotten worse. He's gotten worse.
Yeah. Some of my best friends are
really back deep.
By like 2027, he'll just be like,
I do. I am grateful that he decided to deal with a massive conflict of interest in December of 2025. Glad we got there after months of negotiating deals, agriculture deals.
Unbelievable. And of course, you know, there was the bailout. He's also, Trump has sort of finally, I guess this was like a couple weeks ago, maybe last month, lifted the tariffs on all the food that we don't actually grow here. Yeah. You know, he finally realized that we don't make bananas in the United States and coffee. So a little late on that.
Not with that attitude.
The other challenge is, and I mentioned this at the outset, that like, you know, a lot of the pain from the tariffs still hasn't hit because these big companies have been absorbing the costs, like these retailers. And they're all saying, or a lot of them are saying, that like come January, February, they're going to finally increase prices. So just as Trump and the administration are starting to hope that, you know, inflation hits the Fed's target and things start to settle down and people start to feel the effect of the tax cuts come April when they get their return, like retailers are going to, you know, the tariffs that still exist, retailers are going to start raising the prices.
Yeah, it's also like there's so many ways in which this is unfair. You know, we say tariffs as a shorthand, but like why are farmers struggling? Like it's the higher cost for inputs that they need. It's the trade war itself, making it so they can't sell what they're growing around the world. How do you measure that? How do you measure the cost of someone not being able to sell some of their income going down? They're not paying a tariff on something they can't sell. So it all ends up being a bailout that, yes, goes to the wealthiest companies, but more broadly, there are plenty of people that are deserving of relief in the same way these farmers are deserving of relief that will receive nothing. There are people whose businesses have been decimated by Trump's haphazard and chaotic tariff policies, and they're not getting a dime from him.
You heartened by the bold executive order on price fixing, Tommy?
It's not a bad idea. I mean, it's a bad, well, do something about it. Like, I don't think we need a blue ribbon commission. Like, the ag industry is unbelievably consolidated. There's like four companies. They control 85% of the beef market, 70% of pork, half the poultry industry. But I have zero confidence that Donald Trump will go after any of these companies because they are big fans of Republicans and are probably pouring money into his ballroom and his coffers. And, you know, it's just like, great. Announce a blue ribbon commission that'll give us a report in 6 months and
crazy.
Then you will do what?
Yeah, it reminds me of whenever gas prices would go through the roof, Chuck Schumer would do like a Sunday press conference in front of a gas station being like, we got to stop this gouging.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I got a bill.
As long as I've been alive and in politics, I've never noticed any kind of gouging actually be taken care of by a political policy.
No, I'm excited in this speech to see the delta between the prepared remarks and what he actually says. You know, because, you know, he's got smart people in there. They know that they need to like, he needs to be like, I feel your pain. I'm listening. I'm going to do something about it. We owe you more. But his instinct is going to be, stop your bitching. I gave you the best economy in the world. This is a hoax. Prices are down. Remember eggs? All you guys were talking about is eggs. You know, how about your eggs now? And like, I think we're just going to hear all these demands for credit and repetition and accomplishments. It's going to sound like Joe Biden yelling about AUKUS, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe he'll be yelling about AUKUS. Maybe
why not?
Trump will. It's
couldn't
not hurt. Whatever he says, it seems like we're going to be hearing this for a whole year.
Good luck.
Susie Wiles was on some MAGA podcast today that I couldn't quite recognize. Huh. And she said that they're going to flip the script in this midterm, and she's putting Trump on the ballot. She's usually the president. They don't want to put the president on the ballot, but she's putting Trump on the ballot, and that she wants them to campaign in 2026, quote, like it's 2024 again.
Okay.
Cool. Oh, she's on Pod Force One. It's like the New York Post.
There was something with MAGA Moms too. She was on that.
Okay,
one
good
recently.
For her. Oh no, I'm sorry. This was July 10th.
Yeah, yeah. It was something MAGA called
Moms.
MAGA Moms, but not Katie Miller.
Not Katie Miller.
The headsets were on that.
And she got the big Elon interview.
She got the big Elon interview. Oh, she did.
I saw it previewed, but I didn't actually watch it because she is
anyway.
Painfully
we're doing promo for her. We're
yeah,
the only
I don't
ones.
Know why we're doing that?
One thing Trump and Republicans in Congress likely won't be doing anything about, the massive premium hikes that are set to hit in a few weeks for more than 20 million Americans who buy health insurance through the Affordable Care Act. John Thune is keeping the promise he made as part of the deal to end the government shutdown and will give Democrats a vote this Thursday on a 3-year extension of the ACA subsidies.
We did it.
Yeah, we did it. We did it.
Got that vote.
Republicans will be voting no, however.
Yeah.
But they also, they can't seem to agree on any kind of alternative. Some have proposed a 2-year extension with new income limits. This is a proposal by Bernie Moreno and Susan Collins. Others, I believe Bill Cassidy and someone else whose name I can't remember right now, have proposed...
Crapo.
He's still around?
Yeah. Crapo, wow. There's Crapo and the other one, right? Crapo and what's the other C word from that state?
Not Craig with the, remember Larry Craig?
Not him. It was Crapo.
With the foot tapping.
That was
wide stance.
Wide stance. Man, remember that was, there was always rumors about that guy, and then there were stories about him doing that, and then all of a sudden it was reported.
You know what?
That was wild.
Poop. You have to poop one
standing
time.
Standing there with his poor beleaguered wife
Detroit
at that press conference. That poor wife standing by his side of the press conference. None of this is true.
It's a
conspiracy to stop me, America's greatest legislator, Larry Craig of Idaho.
If you're too young or offline to know what we're talking about, just ask ChatGPT. They'll let you know about Larry Craig. Maybe they'll also tell you about the proposal by Crapo. And Crapo?
Crapo.
Did I just say Crapo?
It's Crapo.
So
it's always, you want to say Crapo. Want it to be Crapo.
If he ended up being like a real figure that pissed people off, he'd be called Crapo.
Trump would call him Crapo.
But no one even cares.
I thought you were doing a Blue Sky joke.
Anyway, their proposal is no extension, and all they're going to do is give people below 700% of the poverty line $1,000 in a tax-free savings account.
So crazy.
But all of this is sort of moot since Senate Republicans reportedly won't be, as of this recording at least, coalescing behind a single alternative. Doesn't seem like House Republicans are doing much of anything. I think the House Republican Problem Solver Caucus is probably working with Democrats on something that won't go anywhere, but it doesn't seem like anything's happening, and this is also probably the last week to do anything before January 1st hits, since everyone's, you know, leaving for the holidays, and that's that. So on the Moreno-Collins 2-year extension with limits, that is similar to what the White House, remember they were about to announce that a couple of weeks ago, and then they backed off because Republicans got nervous. Why do you guys think that Trump and Republicans couldn't get their shit together on a single alternative so that at the very least, when Susie Wiles is making Donald Trump campaign like it's 2024, he and other Republican candidates have something to tell people that they tried on healthcare?
So here's what's confusing to me about this. So John Kennedy from Louisiana, who always is good for a great quote, said this Politico. Have you ever heard of a Rorschach test? Let's smear it all over the wall. That's where the negotiations are at internally among the Republicans. So what's going on in the House makes sense, which is there's a small number.
Nothing.
What?
Nothing.
Which is nothing,
yeah,
right?
That always makes sense.
Because right. There's a number of Republicans, I think, that would vote for some sort of compromise extension to try to save their seats. But the vast majority of House Republicans don't want to do that, which means we're in a situation that doesn't look that different from previous votes like this. There's a majority that would pass an extension. But if Johnson allows that vote to take place, he will lose the speakership. He can only lose 2 or 3 at this point. So that makes sense. In the Senate, I actually don't understand what's happening because there is this compromise proposal that, given it already has 2 Republicans on board, would have a majority in the Senate. And I don't see why a bunch of them don't just get on board and send it over to die in the House because they're going. I do think it's a genuine, like, ideological objection to the extensions. And it's because they fucked up, because if they had put in place limits on the extensions and allowed those extensions to go forward, they would have made Obamacare more conservative. They would have been able to put in place a bunch of reforms. What they've done is allow it to lapse. And so anything they do is reviving the subsidies that currently will not exist on January 1st. And a lot of them just don't want to do that. And so, you know, Rick Scott is also somebody that's been in favor of just doing these this sort of money in people's pockets for healthcare, which doesn't do anything to resolve the problem, which is if you don't have health insurance and you have a medical event, you will go bankrupt. That's why people need insurance. So I don't understand what's happening in the Senate, because they would obviously be served politically by just sending something to the House.
Yeah, I mean, the health savings account plans would not only not solve the problem for most people, it would make the problem much, much worse, because healthy young people would just not get health insurance. They would spend down the HSAs whenever they needed health care, and then premiums would go up for everyone else, and the ACA would go into a death spiral. I asked a Republican who worked on the Hill on healthcare a bunch and said, like, why isn't there an alternative? And this person said, either they don't care about healthcare and give no thoughts to policy, or they live in 2014 when just being against the ACA is all they know to say on the issue. Yeah. And that sounded about right to me, because there's like a couple dozen Republicans in swing districts. They are completely freaked out. They know they're going to lose. Tony Fabrizio said they'd be down 15 points if they fail to extend these tax credits, and they're likely to lose their seats. But the rest of them are in crazy gerrymandered seats or safe states, and they just don't want to vote for Obama anything, for ideological reasons or for, you know, policy reasons. And Trump was asked about it today, and he tried to do like a Luigi Mangione impression. He was like, Democrats are in the pocket of the health insurance industry. It's like, what are you talking about, dude? And then he seemed to endorse an HSA plan, but he still doesn't have his own.
Yeah, they're trying to say that because technically the expanded subsidies go to the insurance companies, that somehow it's making the insurance companies richer, which is them not realizing that people can easily just look up the fact that the money is paid to the insurance companies, and then they are required by law to pass the savings on to the consumer. That's the whole point of the subsidies.
And also, change them. If you have a problem with how lucrative they are for the insurance companies, you have the ability to legislate anything you want to extend the subsidies to address your concerns.
But it's just a pass through the insurance companies. It's nothing else.
But they have a problem, right? They claim to have a problem with the fact there's a lot of people that sign up for Obamacare and never use it over the course of the year. There's a lot of, like, they have genuine ideological and policy questions. There are people that actually think about healthcare on the Republican side. They're just not willing to actually put anything forward, because they just have never, in 20 years of talking about healthcare, aligned on any kind of a vision.
I imagine that the Collins Moreno proposal is one for, I mean, Collins is the only one in a truly vulnerable seat right now, who's a Senate Republican. I mean, you could also say that
Moreno's like close enough.
I guess like the guy that's running against Sherrod, whatever his face is, Hursted something. He's John Hursted. Who knows? He'll probably say he's for that.
Husted.
That's close.
You could better be pretty than good. Crapo. Hey, pretty good.
So, you know, you can imagine the people in vulnerable seats and in the House too saying they were for 2-year extension, and the Democrats just wanted to give the subsidies to rich people. You know, they could run a campaign like that. But I do think Republicans control the White House and Congress, and most voters would say, well, gee, since you controlled everything, why didn't you make your little plan happen? If you controlled everything. Senator Josh Hawley, he said to Burgess Everett, reporter at Semaphore today, Republicans had better offer something. I mean, what signal will it send if Republicans say, we're going to say no to the Democrats' plan, but we're not going to offer anything? The message that will send is, good luck to the American people. We don't really care. And Hawley said he wouldn't even rule out voting for the 3-year extension on Thursday.
I had a question about this, and I wonder if you thought about this, which is, I'm glad we got a discharge petition through on the Epstein files, which is obviously making a difference for everybody this Christmas. But presumably there are a majority of House members that would sign on to an extension, maybe an extension with some kind of cap, some version of the Senate proposal. Like, make them decide not to support that, because you'd instantly get every Democrat to sign some kind of a compromise.
Yeah, they tried, apparently. And even the Don Bacons of the House were like, we're not signing a discharge petition on the 3-year extension. We will come up with our own bipartisan compromise.
Right, but do one of these
it's out there.
It's happening.
Because they're trying to work in some politically damaging things, like, you know, it has to cut funding for states that provide healthcare to undocumented people, or like further reductions in payments for abortion services.
Yeah,
they just want to make it politically painful.
Yeah, Hyde Amendment stuff they wanted to include in that.
But I agree with you. I mean, it's the obvious smart thing for them to do is just pass it.
I think that this is one of the stupider fucking moves from the public. I mean, aside from being awful on policy and hating that, like, it's just politically a real head scratcher, because I think they feel maybe they've avoided the pain so far, but the pain hasn't really hit yet. And when they're campaigning and healthcare premiums are up and the tariffs are still there and big companies are raising costs again, like, I don't think it's getting better for them.
No. And this is their voters too.
Yeah. Pod Save America is brought to you by Helix. You know, it's getting colder, and sometimes people like to spend a little more time cozied up in the bedroom, but you're going to need a really comfy mattress, and that's where Helix comes in.
Mm-hmm.
Helix is the most awarded mattress brand, tested and reviewed by experts like Forbes and Wired, and us, we're experts.
You bet we are.
In mattresses.
When we were in D.C., people used to call you a mattress expert.
The Helix offers a variety of mattresses designed to fit your sleep needs. How will you know which Helix mattress works best for you and your body? You take the Helix Sleep Quiz. It matches you with the perfect mattress based on your personal preferences, making it easy to find a mattress that fits your sleep needs. Helix delivers your mattress right to your door with free shipping in the U.S. Rest easy with seamless returns and exchanges. The Happy with Helix Guarantee offers a risk-free, customer-first experience designed to ensure you're completely satisfied with your new mattress. They even offer a 120-night sleep trial and limited lifetime warranty. Go to helixsleep.com/crooked for 27% off site-wide. That's helixsleep.com/crooked for 27% off site-wide. This offer is exclusive to Pod Save America listeners. Make sure you enter our show name into the post-purchase survey so they know we sent you. helixsleep.com/crooked.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
Monday also brought more exciting news in the war over which mega corporation will achieve total control of the entertainment industry.
Hell yeah.
You probably saw that Netflix has, at least for now, won the bidding war for Warner Brothers Discovery, agreeing to pay $72 billion in a deal that would give them the Warner Brothers half of the company, which includes the TV and movie studios, as well as HBO Max. The Discovery half, which includes CNN and other cable networks, would split off on its own, though they could always go after that half later. But none of this is final. On Monday, David Ellison's Paramount Skydance, which recently absorbed what's left of CBS and CBS News, was reportedly preparing to launch a hostile takeover bid for Warner Brothers Discovery. Ellison, whose father Larry is the billionaire founder of Oracle and friends with Trump, called the Netflix offer, quote, inferior, and told CNBC on Monday, quote, we're really here to finish what we started. Love it. People are going to hear your interview with Bloomberg's Lucas Shaw on this in a bit. But any headlines from that that we should know about?
Hollywood is pretty freaked out. The Ellisons are pissed, but could put together more money. And Trump has a lot of power.
And Paramount is bringing some pals along if they go forward with the latest bid. They're making the offer along with sovereign wealth funds from Saudi Arabia, Abu Dhabi, Qatar, and of course, no gang of Gulf autocrats. Trying to curry favor with Trump would be complete without the involvement of the man who was the president's second choice to marry Ivanka after Tom Brady, Jared Kushner.
He's like a chaperone.
Jared's private equity firm, Affinity Partners, going in on the bid could help grease the wheels with regulators, especially because the Trump administration has already indicated it views the Netflix offer with, quote, heavy skepticism. But because Trump is also a messy bitch who loves drama, he posted a statement on Monday that was quite critical of Paramount for allowing CBS News's 60 Minutes to air an interview with Marjorie Taylor Greene in which she dared to criticize Trump. Quote, from the truth, my real problem was that the new ownership of 60 Minutes, Paramount, would allow a show like this to air. All caps, they are no better than the old ownership who just paid me millions of dollars for fake reporting about your favorite president, me. Since they bought it, 60 Minutes has actually gotten worse. Tough review for Barry Weiss.
I wonder if there's a lesson there for everybody else.
And here's Trump fielding a question on the deal during his White House event on Monday.
You spoke about Netflix last night, saying you have concerns about them.
I know the companies very well. I know what they're doing, but I have to see. I have to see what percentage of market they have. I mean, none of them are particularly great friends of mine.
Paramount deal is supported by Jared Kushner, Mr. President. Would that impact your decision?
If Paramount is? I don't know. I've never spoken to him. He's really trying to work on Gaza. I think Gaza's his primary thing is Gaza.
Tommy, do you think this deal is... this hostile takeover bid could work now that the man who negotiated the Abraham Accords is on the case?
Yeah. First of all, way to bribe him there, CBS. You guys nailed that. Also, the lighting there was so bad.
Very, very gold. Very amber.
Golden dome. I mean, just Jared Jared's participation is pure, uncut corruption. Like the Paramount is just like, okay, let's bring this idiot. Maybe he can grease it from the inside. Maybe he can make this deal happen. And remember that the money Jared is investing is almost entirely from investment funds controlled by the Saudis, the Emiratis, and Qatar. I think it's 99% of the like $5 billion in assets yet. So he is a middleman with zero experience in like streaming or studios. It's just political ties and corruption. And, you know, you have to ask, like, okay, at the same time, so the Saudi, Emirati, and Qatari sovereign wealth funds have put up $24 billion to help finance this deal. So those sovereign wealth funds paid Jared. So they're paying him a fee to be part of an investment that they're also a part of on their own. Very interesting.
Nice work if you get it.
Great business. Also, the sovereign wealth funds have agreed to have no say in the governance of the future company. So no board seats, no voting rights, presumably to get around the national security process that could block the deal, the CFIUS process. So you have to wonder, like, why are these guys excited to be part of a deal that this merger, where they're wildly overpaying for assets to create a company they can't control? And like, I think it's about control, right? It's like changing the cultural conversation.
I think they just love
journalism.
Cinema.
Yeah, they love cinema. It's about, you know, like washing their reputation. I mean, the whole thing is just pretty gross.
Yeah. So we don't even, I talked to Lucas about this a little bit, and actually it's, we don't totally understand their motivation, right? Because they do claim to be giving up control. They do like the idea of diversifying into these other areas. At the same time, like, because this is such a big Netflix, there's so many pieces to this. Like CNN is at stake in this as well. Netflix has said they don't want the cable business, so that, you know, Discovery Global would spin off. Ellison has said he would want it. He would keep
it.
It
all.
And would make CNN and CBS a kind of Barry Weiss Gundam that she would control, probably. Now, I asked actually Lucas about this, about would Ellison acquire CNN anyway if Netflix spun it off? And he actually thought he might, but didn't actually think that anybody, that the cable business is something you get if you do this deal, but nobody would want it independently, basically. Which may be a possibility.
It does seem like, first of all, we should talk about like the power Trump has in to stop this deal, because it's not as clear cut as I thought, at least when I first started reading about it. Because first of all, the FCC has no role here because there's not like local television stations at stake.
DOJ.
And so it's DOJ. DOJ could ask a judge for an injunction. And so they could maybe delay it for a couple months, but then the judge would have to grant the injunction. So they can try to block it, but it's not completely in the hands of Trump's DOJ. I do think he is playing coy and, like, you know, maybe it's too much market share for Netflix, but also Ted Sarandos is fantastic. And also I might be pissed at Paramount because 60 Minutes and Barry Weiss aren't. Yeah, it's leverage. And if this takes, 18 months to close, you know, that's like a good part of the rest of Trump's term. And he can have all these companies, all three of these companies, just kissing his ass and giving him all the content, all the Rush Hour movies he wants. He's already got Rush Hour 4 coming out now.
He's got another cameo in a Batman movie. He's coming his way.
Yeah.
But not enough. What was
Home Alone.
Right. Yeah. So he doesn't have the ability to, he doesn't have the singular ability to stop it, but he does have the ability to approve it. I do think also all this, you know, him sort of going after Paramount today is a way of saying for the next 18 months, everybody better be so nice to me. It's my birthday. It's my birthday until one of these deals is approved. Yeah. I talked about this with Lucas as well. Like I've seen a bunch of people come out against these deals and I understand why. And people have genuine concerns about what this consolidation would mean. But I also do wonder what happens if people come up with what they'd want Trump, you know, Trump claims he wants to save Hollywood, right? He comes like, I'm going to be the guy that saves Hollywood. Well, if Trump wants to be the savior of Hollywood, there's billions and billions of dollars Netflix has put on the table if this deal gets stopped, right? That's leverage Trump has to make all kinds of demands, even though in any other administration it wouldn't happen that way.
Are you guys rooting for Netflix because Sarandos isn't as tight with Trump as the Ellisons? Or is it still just, I mean, Netflix controlling Warner Brothers, that is a big market share right there.
I think it's complicated. I think the best outcome is no merger at all, but there are political equities and there's like business and Hollywood equities. I think from a political perspective, I'm not excited about Paramount because you don't want like a Trump-aligned billionaire and his annoying kid having an even larger amount of market share and power in Hollywood. Antitrust advocates might say, though, that a supersized Paramount could create a streaming competitor to Netflix that might be a good thing for consumers or for Hollywood if, you know, trying to get more buyers out there in the market who make TV and film. The pushback to that, though, is like, I don't know, even if a deal goes through, like, no matter what, there's one less buyer, and that's not a good thing for people selling stuff. And then if Netflix wins, like, there are a lot of potential downsides. It gives them a huge chunk of the streaming business. Paramount says it's 40%. I don't know how to vet that. But, like, they're the number one and number three biggest streamers. It means one less buyer in the market making stuff. It could kill the movie theater business because Netflix wants to get movies onto its streaming platform faster, and that could drastically shorten theatrical release times. And then there's also just a question of, like, okay, so how is Netflix going to pay for this? Like, what costs are they going to cut? Are they going to fire people? Are they going to shut down lots? Are they going to raise prices? There was one analyst who said, where's my numbers? There's one analyst estimated that the deal needs to increase Netflix's cash flow by $8 billion per year for the next 20 years to justify itself. That's a lot of money. And then there's, like, a third theory out there that just, like, actually Netflix doesn't really care if they close the deal. They just want to freeze Warner Brothers Discovery for 18 to 24 months while the process goes on, and keep them from getting sold elsewhere, and then just, like, press their advantage in streaming. Who knows if that's true, but it's an interesting theory.
Yeah, the other side of it, though, is, according to the proposals, there's even more cuts if Warner Brothers and Paramount merge, because those companies have more overlap.
Yeah, totally.
There's this idea that Netflix is the death of movie theaters. Maybe it is, but when Fox and Disney when Disney acquired 20th, there were 44% fewer releases because there's just one less studio, and those are both companies that believe in the movie business.
Yep.
And I do worry about what happens if CNN comes under the control of a Trump loyal family. It's one less independent media company. So I don't think there's really any great outcomes in either acquisition. I guess the hope would be that this gets dragged out, the Netflix deal gets killed, and somehow in the interim, the Paramount deal falls apart too. But if right now, I think people are being a little too cavalier about saying the Netflix deal should be stopped without accepting that the downwind consequence of that is the Paramount one happens, and there's a ton of bad outcomes for that too.
I will say, one of the arguments Netflix is making is that their, you know, their real competition is not with just other streamers, but TikTok, YouTube, and it is a bleak argument that may or may not be true. But, like, the idea that they see themselves at least as competing for eyeballs with all the wonderful stuff that we see on TikTok.
I mean, they're absolutely right. I mean,
and they are. And it's just like, that is, and if it tells you something about the future of where they want to go.
I think it's like, I do think that all entertainment is losing, like, time and mind share to TikTok, you know, mostly TikTok. But the idea that that doesn't make it like a monopoly issue is absurd.
No, it's for sure. I was raising it because, some of the Netflix shows you see look like just a couple TikToks strung together.
For sure.
Well, look, I think the TikTok argument is a little bit of a stretch. I don't think it's unfair to say that they're competing with YouTube. They are competing with YouTube. And also, by the way, YouTube spends a ton of money on original content now. It's not prestige scripted television. There's a way in which I feel like a lot of people that are really worried about this and are rightly to be worried about this, I always feel like we're just sort of following behind these sort of inexorable changes and complaining about them, and also not really dealing with, like, what I do think are complexities, which is these companies do spend huge amounts on original content. And I want movie theaters to survive, but then you look at the numbers, and the entire movie business this year is maybe going to be $9 billion, the domestic box office, and it is dwarfed by the amount of money. Like, Apple alone is going to spend almost $5 billion on content this year. Netflix is around 17 or 18. YouTube is $30 billion. Like, they're spending huge amounts of money and making incredible, you know, television shows that we would say are some of the best television shows ever made. So I guess I would like to. I feel like the conversation needs to turn to, what does it look like to put pressure on these companies and maybe put pressure on a deal like this to get to a better version of where we're heading, as opposed to constantly having a conversation about the dangers of consolidation and of Silicon Valley's invasion of Hollywood.
Pod Save America is brought to you by Aura Frames. Why is it so hard to find a personal gift for the people you're closest to? I don't know. The longer you've known them, that's a lot of years. That's a lot of personal gifts. At some point, it's you run out. That's where Aura Frames comes in. For anyone still hunting for the right gift, Aura Frames makes it look like you planned it all along. Every frame comes packaged in a premium gift box with no price tag, so there is no gift wrapping necessary. You can even preload photos before it ships and keep adding from anywhere, anytime. Upload unlimited photos and video to your frame for free. Just download the Aura app and connect to Wi-Fi. It only takes about 2 minutes to set up a frame using the Aura app. The app allows you to share photos and videos effortlessly at any time, straight from your phone. If you want to personalize your gift, you can add a message before it arrives. You can't wrap togetherness, but you can frame it. For a limited time, save on the perfect gift by visiting AuraFrames.com to get $35 off Aura's best-selling Carver Matte Frames, named number one by Wirecutter, by using promo code Crooked at checkout. That's AuraFrames.com, promo code Crooked. This deal is exclusive to listeners, and frames sell out fast, so order yours now to get it in time for the holidays. Support the show by mentioning us at checkout. Terms and conditions apply.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on two purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
While we're talking about the economy, business, and regulations, it's worth touching on the latest in artificial intelligence. With a post on Truth Social Monday morning, Trump promised to sign an executive order this week that would attempt to sweep away any state regulations that try to guardrail AI. Here's some of what Trump wrote. There must be only one rulebook if we are going to continue to lead in AI. There can be no doubt about this. AI will be destroyed in its infancy. You can't expect a company to get 50 approvals every time they want to do something. That will never work. What do you guys think? Think there's anything else behind Trump not wanting states to pass any AI regulations?
Yeah, I just think all these AI companies are racing as fast as they can to build the most powerful product. And they believe that this is going to be, if not a winner takes all, a winner takes most industry. And the difference between being like number one and number two will be trillions of dollars. So they're trying to compete. They're trying to train models. They're trying to buy all the chips. They're competing for power, like literally like physical power from, you know, electricity. And they're spending billions of dollars. So the stakes are so high and they just don't want any guardrails in the way. And they want the status quo. And I think they're willing to pay for it. Like they're paying off the Trump administration. And, you know, you have AI safety experts pointing out that restaurants now face more regulations and safety standards than AI companies. And the companies involved don't care, right? Like Sam Altman doesn't care. Mark Zuckerberg, Elon Musk, they don't care. And so they know that Washington is broken, Congress won't get anything done, and that often the way regulation gets done in this country is California passes a law, and then that becomes the de facto standard because we're so big that other, you know, every company follows it. And Trump is pretending that this executive order will preempt that. I don't think it's going to work in any way in practice. But these companies are all kissing his ass and pouring political favors in his pocket and showing up at the White House all the time and going to dinners and, you know, paying off to build the ballroom and whatever. And I think that's why he's doing this.
Yeah, I think the only positive in it is hoping that the reason he's doing this is because it looks like the hopes for passing something through Congress are falling apart. And the people were really worried about that and a provision was going to get snuck into this must-pass defense bill because Congress is barely able to govern, if that barely is generous. They end up sticking really important random bills attached to must-pass bills, like a defense, a military bill. So if that has fallen out, they're doing this as a cope. And to Tommy's point, yeah, won't have nearly the same impact, if any impact. So it seems like he's doing it as a favor hit to his pals. And while there are also people who genuinely believe that we are in a race against China and anything that limits America's sort of rapacious building of server farms and data centers and you know power plants to support them will mean we don't create the singular AI god before China does, at which point we'll all work for the Chinese version.
Yeah, these people all paid for access, right? You know, and they've got their access. They're best buddies with Trump now, and I think persuading him on this is quite easy. And his staff, I think they sit down with him and they say, okay, look at the economy right now. We have an economy that's built on data centers and private prisons. Mm-hmm. Nothing else is really, and healthcare, I guess. There's the healthcare sector is growing. Nothing else is growing. And so if you want to be a successful president, you want the economy to continue to chug along as it is, you're going to have to support AI as fast as development of AI as fast as possible, right? Then there's the beat China thing. There's also the, by the way, you don't want, and Trump has said this in Truth Posts before, you don't want these blue states like California, you don't want this commie California to develop some woke AI that we're going to have to contend with, right? Now, the challenge is a whole bunch of states have already started passing regulations on AI around political deepfakes, non-consensual sexual imagery. They have passed regulations to try to prevent AI from being used to discriminate. But it is a complete fake order. Like, it doesn't do anything. What's going to happen is if a state has a regulation that the Trump administration doesn't like, the Trump administration can then decide through the DOJ to try to sue the state and see if that works. They'll probably say it's, you know, interstate commerce clause, that the feds are supposed to be able to regulate interstate commerce. The challenge is they're going to make the argument that, like, we need one federal set of regulations on AI because you can't have a patchwork set of like 50 different regulations, but they don't have a federal set of regulations. So it's hard to tell the states you can't do anything until maybe someday we do something in the federal government. Like,
right,
it's one thing to say the federal regulation takes precedent over the state regulation. You have a good legal argument there. I don't know that you do by saying we're getting around to it, but in the meantime, you can't do anything.
It's like the healthcare vote. They want to veto any legislative effort they don't agree with or that restricts these abilities company to operate across different states, but they just don't have a policy that they can coalesce around to regulate AI in the way that it obviously needs to be regulated. So they cannot govern. They cannot put together a proposal to pass something. So they're going to do this instead.
You're right. I mean, the stock market is entirely propped up by AI, and he has a huge incentive to keep that bubble from bursting because it would be catastrophic. I do think also the crypto example is very instructive. Like, Donald Trump hated cryptocurrency until a bunch of crypto executives came to him and they dumped money on him and created super PACs, and all of a sudden now he loves it. He also hated big tech until they kind of bowed to the altar and now he's a fan. So I just think the China thing is just such bullshit to me because today, Trump advanced that he will allow the sale of the H200 NVIDIA chip to China, which is like they're just below their Blackwell series. It's like the best of the last generation chips, a very powerful chips. And so we're going to send like our second best chips. We're going to get rid of export controls on AI chips because we want to beat China. That makes absolutely no sense. And when you push them on that, they'll be like, well, if we don't give them our chips, they're going to make chips through Huawei. Like, you guys don't think that they're going to subsidize their biggest tech company anyway? I just like don't find it at all believable.
It's a very weird argument. Basically the argument is we want to get them hooked on American technology,
right,
so that they're dependent on the NVIDIA chips. So, but it's also unclear whether China will actually say yes and buy the chips because they might think that it's like a backdoor security risk, in which case, what is the purpose of this whole thing? It's like, if they buy them, then but they're also subsidizing Huawei, like then how are we getting them hooked on NVIDIA technology?
And the Chinese can be like, you know what we're gonna do? We're gonna buy Taiwan with these warships. That's what we're gonna do. That's our policy.
It's a David Sacks brainchild, right? And the other argument they're making is like, well, By allowing NVIDIA to sell some of these to China, it'll just make NVIDIA more money. And if NVIDIA has more money, they'll be able to help the United States beat China to the AI super god again.
Yeah,
we don't know what we're racing towards.
We don't.
The other thing.
And by the way,
is it AGI, right? Artificial general intelligence, or but there's no specific goal here. We're just racing.
How many fucking dogs do you attach to the bobsled before it goes the speed of sound? It's like, it's like a terrifying thing what's happening. And maybe like the idea that they all have like, there's like genuine, like old school kind of competition going on, trying to make the best product and get there first. And that we have seen over the years that in like technology, there are all these economies where one wins and the rest fall. Google, there's other examples. But then it's like, so you're all racing because you have to get there first. There is some sort of super intelligence that you don't understand and that will be smarter than us. And then, oh, by the way, we've spent the last decade building how many fucking data centers and server farms that are currently
of nothing yet.
Inflated value that they all are pretending have more value than they do because the things burn out and they have to replace them. It's like the like awareness of the bubble as we're in the bubble is very reminiscent of several previous terrible financial catastrophes that we've very recently been through.
It is notable that a lot of the opposition to sort of the AI industry going at breakneck speed and specifically Trump's move today is coming from some people in his base, prominent people. Marjorie Taylor Greene, one place where she diverged from Trump. Ron DeSantis has been leading the opposition to this move as well. He was out today with a statement critical of Trump's EO. What do you think? Is this like another sort of wedge issue with Trump's base that Democrats should be taking advantage of here and maybe building new coalitions?
I think so. I mean, look, I think he's a fake populist and we should hammer him for it. And it's this issue. I mean, it's tech companies showering him with money and compliments and they get what they want. The president of Argentina kisses Trump's ass at CPAC. They get a $40 billion bailout. The crypto assholes get their special favors and policies. Like, was it the crypto national reserve? Remember that moment?
Whatever happened to that?
Yeah, I don't know.
Hey, somebody follow up on the crypto national reserve.
Are we filling
that
puppy up?
How are we doing? How much is in the reservoir?
We're pardoning you know, pardoning all the people whose crypto we were going to seize. Cuts Medicaid, does nothing when healthcare prices go up, as we talked about a minute ago. I mean, I do think this is like a piece of the puzzle of just how, rather than drain the swamp, it is just Washington is more bought and sold than ever. And you're hearing this case being made by conservatives. Like, you know, Nick Fuentes was just unloading on Trump on all these grounds too. So it's coming from the left and the right. And I think it's a case worth making.
I think it's also corruption is a piece of it. I think for AI, it goes like well beyond that as well. I mean, it is the DeSantis, Marjorie Taylor Greene have voiced concerns about the job loss. I mean, you've heard, you know, Tucker Carlson has had this debate with like Ben Shapiro like a year ago or something where I think Tucker said, you know, he would if you could stop. We're going to have these driverless cars. And if you could have a regulation stopping the creation of driverless cars because it's going to get rid of all the truckers and all the trucking jobs in this country, he would do it. And so there's going to be this massive potential job displacement that a lot of folks on the right, in a more sort of protectionist way, are going to say, like, they don't like. There is, like, what it's going to do to our kids. It's sort of the social media phone argument on steroids. So you get a lot of some of the more religious conservatives concerned about that. So there are a host of reasons beyond just corruption that, like, the Republican base or the MAGA base is, like, really worried about when it comes to AI. And the polling bears this out as well. Like, you know, Harvard just did their big youth poll. And for among young people, only 14% said that AI will create more opportunities and 44% said that it will take away more opportunities. That's young people who are usually, you know, kind of enamored with new technology. Emerson just did a poll in Pennsylvania. 48% of voters think that AI will have a negative impact on the economy. Only 25% said positive. 55% of people in Pennsylvania believe that AI will decrease jobs in the industry they work in. Personal a thing. And then only 16% said increase. And then there's a big, huge Pew poll from the summer. AI will worsen our ability to think creatively. 53% believe that. Only 16% disagree. And form meaningful relationships. 50% agree with that. Only 5% disagree.
One challenge is how many different kinds of technology AI represents, because it is both something that will drive cars. It is something that will replace writers. There's so many implications of it, some of which are awesome and great that we should be very much excited about, some of which
biomedical sphere specifically, I think.
Some of which are great tools for artists to use in ways that help their productivity. Some are purely parasitic. And some that can only exist because they are drafting off of stolen art or using art to kind of replicate what an artist might do in a world where this technology didn't exist. Friends, all of this stuff like has all these sort of negative consequences, but we're not like, because Trump is in the pocket of these industries, there's so many ways in which we're not having those debates and there's no hope of any kind of real like reforms or regulations to rein that in. Like they've already trolled and stolen so much information to make their database of language to turn around Super Google. So
Yeah. It's totally unsettling. I mean, parents are also just watching their kids use AI to cheat at school all day, and they're not learning anything. And like, meanwhile, Australia is banning social media for kids under 16. And we're letting the same companies run by the same assholes figure out AGI. Like, this is a terrible setup. Everyone, you don't really have to explain that to a lot of people.
And it's going to happen so much faster than any other technological development. I think that is one of the big differences here. I mean, it is more powerful than past technological developments, but that's usually the case. But just the speed, like, we're all like, oh, well, Trump's here now. Maybe we can figure this out, you know, in 2028. Like, it's happening. Like you said, the stuff is being stolen right now. The technology is being developed right now. It's all happening.
The other thing, too, is all these sort of costs that are not being incurred by these companies that are being incurred by people who never signed up for them. Like, I saw a teacher being interviewed talking about how a big part of a teacher's job now is trying to figure out if AI wrote something. And a student will generate an essay in 10 seconds that will take hours for that teacher to untangle. They didn't train to figure out what AI is.
You know what the proposed solution for that is?
Yeah.
Develop an AI more that can AI. Help tell you whether the college essay was written by AI. That's seriously what
it exists.
Yeah. One thing for sure is that whatever happens, we would never want some commie blue state to pass any kind of regulation that would deprive our right-wing influencers from using AI to anthropomorphize dead presidents for the sake of content, as Glenn Beck has apparently done with George Washington, guys. Let's listen.
If I may speak plainly, my countrymen, the danger, the greatest danger to our republic lies not in foreign arms or political faction, but in the decay...
May I just interrupt you for a second? Could you just dumb it down just a little bit?
Okay. Let me speak to Americans. If I'm honest, America's biggest problem isn't political or economic. It's on moral. You know, where are the citizens who value duty over comfort, principle over popularity? America was built to be a moral and self-governing nation.
So are you guys more or less worried about AI after that?
That's George Washington with some testosterone gel, who's like a big fan of like
talking about
looks maxing.
Why am I wearing the same shirt as George Washington? Yeah.
Why is George Washington wearing the same shirt as you?
Yeah, he's got sick hair. He's got nice flow.
Good
well,
build.
It's interesting that that George Washington, they made him talk like so we do today, like, but they didn't fix the hair. The hair is still this old.
He looks like an Oompa Loompa. Is what he looks like.
It does
he
look like an Oompa Loompa. An Oompa Loompa that sounds suspiciously like Glenn Beck.
Yeah, you know, this is such a like a, this is AI. It's like, this is what I mean. It's like, it can drive a car. It can find new molecules to cure diseases. It also functionally is the same as brainyquotes.net because you can just make it say, like, it's like, you know, reach for the stars, Gandhi. You know, like, that's what this is. Just somebody putting their own, it's like, we can make a face of George Washington saying whatever we want. Exciting.
He left the Blaze, I think was his publication, to do this full time, I think. This AI George. This is his job.
AI George just got nominated for a Golden Globe. And I just that's exciting. Really worked those refs.
And just so everyone knows, Glenn Beck has put that out as the preview. The full conversation. There's a full conversation that is not out yet, at least as of this recording.
And a pretty intimate sex scene with Martha, which is exciting.
Just like couldn't be less compelling, whatever that was.
Also, like him having to, it's not like he just throws AI George Washington up on the screen and lets him go. Like he's interviewing him. He's like, hey, no, slow down, slow down. And also speak like today. Come on, dumb it down for us, AI George. What else will he have him do?
It was just funny how you generated an AI George Washington. He's like, I will not proceed with this interview for even a moment longer until you let me see one of your magic dentists. Please help me. Please help me. I have oak teeth. I haven't had a good night's sleep in several years.
And I still have slaves at home.
And I do have those slaves.
It's my thing. Anyway, there is stuff like that makes you like, okay, maybe we shouldn't worry about AI killing us all because it's doing that. But I do think that's deceiving because so many people like their first encounter with AI is slop garbage like that. And they're like, yeah, maybe it's not so bad. But like, meanwhile, like you said, there's a lot of other things going on with AI that are a lot scarier than that.
Yeah. Can I make one pitch on how we talk about this? Because I do this too. Everyone does this. AI will not be the thing that destroys our jobs or takes over our economy. It will be the people that own the company. It is a tool. It is not a person. It is a tool. And it's a very powerful tool. It's a tool that can displace whole parts of whole jobs and industries.
And it's being created by very powerful tools.
Very powerful tools are in fact in charge.
Yeah.
So there's this way in which we feel like kind of, I don't know, like kind of a strap to this thing that's, and we can't stop it. It's like, no. like, it is an important technology. It will have great uses. We decide that. We have some say over it. And we should, like, I think, take more agency in how we talk about it. In a theoretical
democracy, for sure.
In a theoretical democracy. But when we say AI is stealing the jobs, there will be a person who presses the button who controls the company that makes the money. Those are the people who are taking the jobs.
Yeah.
So Glenn Beck acquired a bunch of historical documents, which he says he's now created a digital vault to put them on the blockchain to ensure that they're not tampered with. Who is tampering with historical documents?
They're historical. Yeah. Aren't they in the public domain? Isn't that why they're historical documents?
I think he's bothered by the fact that at the Library of Congress it now says they, them hold these truths to be self-evident. And I think that was the part that really drove him crazy.
And if you
want to
take a book out, the librarian is Marco Rubio, and so you have to get his permission.
Right. And I think there's that part of the where it says, that like Jefferson was checking his privilege towards the end of the Declaration of Independence, that King George III was not creating enough space.
Bad look, for Hamilton. Liberty.
Yeah. So I think this. I have to understand why that is confusing. But sorry, Glenn, that's what's always been there.
He's so.
All right. When we get back from the break, you'll hear Lovett's conversation with Bloomberg's Lucas Shaw about the battle for Warner Brothers, what it actually means for all of us. Two announcements before we get to that. Big news, guys, for our listeners down under. We are bringing Pod Save America live to New Zealand and Australia for the first time ever. Join us for the 2026 Pod Save America, hopefully just visiting tour.
I do like that name.
Good name.
I
don't want
to give him any ideas over in the White House. We're headed to Auckland on February 11th, and then three shows in Australia after that. Melbourne on February 13th, Brisbane on February 14th, and Sydney on February 16th.
Already getting the pronunciations right.
Yeah, well, they have them here in the script for me, thank God. I would have fucked that up. Go to cricket.com/events to get tickets. And use the code PSA Down Under to get pre-sale tickets now. How exciting is this, guys?
PSA Down Under.
PSA Down Under. Okay. Listen, I wanted PSA After Dark, but you guys said no.
PSA,
we're married.
PSA Dan Under? Is that no?
Oh, hey.
Sure.
That's not bad.
I'll do that
that's
one too. Bad. Sign me up for some of that.
Dan is coming too.
Yeah, Dan's coming.
Dan. Whoa. Easy.
Okay.
Oh, that's the line? Okay.
That is the line.
Got it. Arbitrary
no, I
just line.
Hadn't, I hadn't gotten there yet. I'm glad I'm there.
The point
right
is, Australia, we're
so's
coming.
Dan. Dan's glad you got there too.
He didn't hear
down
it.
Under, down under. The newest, also, this is another announcement. The newest book from Crooked Media Reads is coming out January 27th, 2026. It's called Hated by All the Right People, Tucker Carlson and the Unraveling of the Conservative Mind by one of our favorite political journalists, New York Times Magazine writer Jason Zangerli. Why a book about Tucker Carlson? Pfft, why not? In a lot of ways, Tucker's rise is what made the Trump age possible. He is an extremely influential figure on the right. And Jason's book gets inside, you know, what happened, how his rise came about. It's an excellent book.
It's so good. I've read it. It's a fantastic book. It is such a great, like, you follow Tucker's career, but it also traces the arc of the MAGA movement and how it's kind of lost it a little bit lately.
You think?
Really, a little bit, a little bit.
Book comes out January 27th, but if you pre-order a copy now, you can get 15% off with code JASON15 at cricket.com/books. What a code. That's cricket.com/books, and the code is JASON15.
Yeah.
It's not exactly Yes We Dan or PSA Down Under, but it is JASON15.
It's JASON15. 1-5.
1-5.
It's like Adam 22, but different.
Pod Save America is brought to you by Armra. True self-reliance starts with taking control of your own health. Armra Colostrum is nature's original solution. Colostrum is packed with over 400 bioactive nutrients that fortify gut health and strengthen immune health to build resilience at the cellular level. Because when you invest in your health, you invest in your ability to show up, think clearly, and stay in control, no matter what life throws your way. Probiotics are touted as a gut health solution, but they only address one part of the four-part gut wall. Armour Colostrum naturally fortifies your entire gut wall system, nourishing your microbiome and strengthening the gut wall architecture, helping to guard against everyday threats. Armour Colostrum is your secret to feeling strong, vibrant, and confident again. The bioactive nutrients in Armour Colostrum work at the cellular level to ignite inside-out transformation for whole-body benefits, including hair, skin, and more. These bioactive nutrients act as a blueprint for your body, promoting your cell's natural renewal processes to support skin, hair, gut health, metabolism, immune health, lean muscle, and whole body vitality. We've worked out a special offer for our audience. Receive 30% off your first subscription offer. Go to armor.com/crooked or enter crooked to get 30% off your first subscription order. That's ARMRA.com/crooked.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
Joining me now is managing editor of Bloomberg News and author of Bloomberg's Screen Time newsletter and the reporter who broke the story of Netflix's successful bid to buy Warner Brothers, Lucas Shaw. Welcome to the pod.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
So why is Netflix, which has never grown via acquisition before, interested in buying Warner Brothers?
Two reasons, one offensive, one defensive. I think for offensive reasons, look, it's a great asset, right? It's got one of the great film and television studios, one that's been around for more than a century, has shows that Netflix knows are popular already with its customers, like Friends, which used to be on Netflix, now on HBO Max, a bunch of movies. It's got HBO, which is a premium brand to which Netflix once aspired and has since sort of eclipsed. And so if it can buy that, feed it in, get all of these hit shows that it can offer to its customers, it makes its proposition much stronger. And then defensive, you know, it's got this new kid on the block, David Ellison, spending money like crazy because he's got it from his dad. And they, you know, they don't want, he's already swallowed Paramount and they don't want to risk him adding Warner Brothers as well.
So, it seems as though Paramount was caught off guard because they thought this was theirs to lose. Now Paramount is launching a hostile bid. But Paramount is a smaller company. Forget Netflix. It's a smaller company than Warner Brothers. So this is only possible because Ellison has his fortune, plus there's cash from the Saudis, the Qataris, the Emiratis. There's funds from Jared Kushner's investment firm. Twice as much of the money, at least from the bid that we heard about last week, comes from the Middle East as comes from the Ellisons.
The Ellison family, as well as this company, Redbird, which is a private equity firm, they would be the controlling shareholders, have a lot of the economic interests. But it was interesting on Monday morning where they issued one press release that didn't mention some of this other financing. And then in the filing that they had to put out, it did disclose. Look, I can't fully explain the thinking behind why kind of Middle Eastern petrostates do what they do. They have been spreading their money around and investing in a kind of diversifying beyond oil, trying to gain also, I think, soft power through investments in sports and media, right? There's a kind of a Saudi affiliated group that just bought or is the primary acquirer of Electronic Arts, the big video game publisher that makes Madden and other things. So I think they see an opportunity to, you know, buy an interesting, sexy asset that will hopefully make money for them in the long run and give them more influence on a global stage. It also means that they're closely tied in business with the Ellison family, which is, you know, good people to be close to, with the Kushners. And you know, if Trump blesses it, also gets them another sort of point of contact with the Trump administration.
So let's talk about that, whether Trump blesses it. It's been interesting seeing it taken as a given that Jared Kushner being associated with the Ellison bid is a sign that it would have a smoother path to approval, the like kind of acceptance of the fact that there is so much sort of interpersonal relationships and just old school corruption here. At the same time, the Ellisons have spent a year doing a fair amount of bootlicking. And then Trump is asked about this. And he says, oh, we got to see. It would be quite a shame for them to have spent a year doing all that sucking up and then end up with nothing to show for it.
Well, look, Ellison's got something already from Larry Ellison's close relationship at the White House, which is they got Paramount, right? They mm-hmm. they went after Paramount very aggressively and got the deal approved reasonably quickly, all things considered. Now I think you've got the president in a pretty good situation for him, where he has two different companies, both of which want to do this deal. And even though he does not have the official power to say yay or nay, he obviously can have a tremendous amount of influence between his relationship with the DOJ and other regulatory agencies, where, you know, Netflix is going to want to make sure that he's happy with their bid. And the Ellisons, who've already been very friendly to him in a lot of ways, are going to do the same. So it positions him as something of a power broker, which he obviously likes.
So in your own reporting, you found that Sarandos had done a lot to work on his Trump relationship. Can you talk about that and how strategic that was in advance of this?
Yeah, I mean, look, the Netflix, I think if you look at the management of the company, is one of the more democratic, by which I mean supportive of the Democratic Party, media companies in the country, right? Reed Hastings, the co-founder, former CEO, has invested a lot of money, especially of late, in political causes, has been a very vocal critic of President Trump. Ted Sarandos' wife, Nicole Levant, was an ambassador in the Obama administration to the Bahamas. So obviously, as a result of that, I mean, the Obamas continued to have a production deal with Netflix, and Sarandos is close to them. And my understanding is that when Trump came back into power in 2024-25, Netflix looked around and said, we don't have a lot of relationships in his inner circle, and we need to fix that. We are one of the biggest and most influential media companies in the world. Netflix has done a really good job over the years of largely evading kind of intense regulatory scrutiny. Now that they are at the size that they are, for that to continue, I think they couldn't be seen as sort of an enemy of the state, if you will, in the way that Trump is routinely attacking NBC or Disney and ABC. Netflix doesn't want to be in that position. And so Ted Sarandos, the co-CEO of Netflix, who's kind of the more charming schmoozy of the two co-CEOs and the Hollywood one, had a dinner at Mar-a-Lago with President Trump last December, which was reported about at the time. It was a very long dinner. I think my understanding is they got along quite well at the dinner and had remained in touch since then, texting, talking, meeting somewhat regularly, including most recently in kind of mid-November, where Ted had a meeting of more than an hour with Trump at the White House. Now, keep in mind, they're not just talking about this deal, right? Donald Trump has been talking a lot about tariffs on the film business that don't make a lot of sense, that people in Hollywood want to influence in some way. There was some concern, I think, early in the administration that he might revisit the idea of net neutrality, which is something that Netflix has strong opinions about. In the most recent meeting, obviously, they wanted to talk about this deal because Netflix was in the middle of what it knew would be a kind of a contentious process.
Yeah, well, it's just, you know, you make the point that, you know, this ostensibly should be in the hands of regulators, and there's a sort of a formal process, and the president is not necessarily directly involved, yet Trump himself is saying it's up to him. And clearly, the actors in this are very concerned of the ways in which he will get involved. So let's talk about what the administration could do. The head of the theater lobbying group called this an unprecedented threat to the global exhibition business. The WGA said the world's largest streaming company swallowing one of its biggest competitors is what antitrust laws were designed to prevent. Roy Price, who was the former head of Amazon Studios, said the long prophesized death of Hollywood may finally arrive. These are dire, dire warnings about this. What are you hearing about why people are so much more concerned about this deal than if the Paramount deal had gone through?
So I actually don't think that that's the case. It's just Netflix won, right? Or won the initial auction. And so people came out strongly against Netflix. I think some of the same people that you mentioned, not all of them, would have been concerned about Paramount, right? I think the guilds, for example, WGA, DJ, representing writers and directors, they don't like the idea of a studio going away, which could happen if Paramount won. I think you're probably right. I think it's the theatrical business, the movie theaters, wouldn't be as worried about Paramount because David Ellison has been very clear that he is a champion of movie theaters and wants to put movies in theaters, whereas Netflix has a long track record of releasing movies straight to the internet and not wanting to have what long stretches of movies being exclusive to theaters. Now, Netflix is saying in this case that they will kind of run Warner Brothers as it has been, and that means putting movies in theaters, but a lot of folks just don't believe them.
Right.
And then as for you know, what you brought up, Roy Price, you know, he used to run one of the biggest competitors to Netflix. And I think there's a lot of concern. And certainly the argument that Paramount has made is that in streaming, Netflix, which is already the biggest player, would get even bigger and stronger. So, look, the entertainment business is freaked out about Warner Brothers trading hands no matter what. I think if you ask right. the average person, they just say, don't sell it. Stay independent. You don't need to do a deal. But it's one thing to sort of believe that philosophically. It's another thing when David Ellison comes and starts throwing money at you. At a certain point, the shareholders do have an obligation to consider a deal, because if your stock was at $12 and now someone wants to give you $30, that's a pretty good deal.
Right. Well, and I take your point that I agree that a lot of people that are being critical of this deal would also be critical of an Ellison deal. But if this deal gets blocked, that is likely what happens. You know, when Disney acquired Fox's studio, the number of releases theatrically went down, even though those are both companies that believe in the movies. Paramount and Warner Brothers look a lot more alike than Netflix and Paramount look alike. So the reason I ask that is only because Trump has a lot of leverage in this moment. And I've seen a lot of talk about block this deal, this deal's better, this deal's worse. I wonder what happens if people start thinking of the ways in which Trump could, through kind of regulators, the government, let's describe it as the federal government, not the vehicle of the Godhead. But if the federal government decided to make some demands upon Netflix and its acquisition, are there changes to the deal that the WGA might like to see made, that the theaters would like to see made, that would make it more appealing?
Yeah, it's, you know, you brought up a point that was interesting, because it's sort of the argument Netflix has made, which is that we have less obvious overlap or fewer kind of redundancies, synergies than Paramount. So, you know, we don't own a big studio, so we will continue to operate it as is. Whereas if Warner Brothers and Paramount came together, they can say that they're going to release more than 30 movies a year, but they probably won't do that. To your point about Disney and Fox, the numbers come down. You know, there are the conditions that Netflix could agree to in the deal that would placate people in the entertainment business. And then there are those that I think would placate regulators. And I think they're not necessarily the same. You know, if Netflix sort of contractually committed to putting movies in theaters, now I'm not sure they're going to do that, but let's say they did, that would certainly, you know, assuage the concerns of something like Cinemas United, which is, I think, the CEO you referenced earlier, mm-hmm. of kind of a theater lobbying group. If they committed to increasing overall spending, which, again, these are all things that they've already publicly said they're going to do. They will continue. Warner Brothers Television Studio will continue to produce shows for third parties. Those are things that would make people feel a little bit better. It, you know, those aren't the most normal conditions for a, you know, the case against Netflix from a federal government standpoint, wouldn't be what's going to happen to the movie theater business, right? Unfortunately, certain businesses rise and fall over time, and it's not the federal government's job to this is not like a business that matters for national security. We all love movies. We want theaters to continue to exist. The federal government's biggest kind of concern when it comes to this deal would be antitrust and whether Netflix has too much power in streaming. And so I think to make people more kind of comfortable on the streaming front, I could see Netflix agreeing to sell or not acquire sort of HBO streaming business in other parts of the world, like if they mm-hmm. had to appease regulators in Europe or Latin America. Here, it's hard to see what they could do on that front. Their argument is just going to be, you combine Netflix and HBO and we still account for less TV viewing than YouTube. That's going to be the crux of their argument.
Right. No, it's funny because what I'm at is, we see all these sort of extraordinary interventions by the Trump administration and ways in which people treat Trump abnormally, right? They lobby him personally. Jared Kushner being part of the deal makes the deal more attractive. And yet, when it comes to how we talk about what the remedies could be, we all redound to the old style of remedies. But Trump seems to have been taking at least some kind of an interest in reviving Hollywood. He'd like to be seen as somebody that does that. Like, I wonder what happens if people, like, if people put their heads together and say, what if we put together what we would like Trump to see make what demands we would like to see Trump make of Netflix, irrespective of what these deals have traditionally looked like.
Right. If you said, okay, Donald Trump, you want to be seen as a savior of Hollywood, you have a bunch of folks lobby him and say, you know, you talked about tariffs, but what about this? Because tariffs don't actually make sense.
Right, right. Well, I mean, here's the thing. Netflix has put $5.8 billion on the table if this falls apart. For scale,
right.
The domestic box office in the United States is maybe going to hit $9 billion if people go see Avatar, right? Like, they put a ton of, but I'm serious, like, they've put a ton of money on the table, right? Like, right. That is leverage, not just as between the parties making the deal. That's leverage the federal government has in this situation.
Right. I guess my question is, do you think that Donald Trump actually cares about some of those initiatives?
I think Donald Trump cares about things in front of him and in how it reflects on him. And Donald Trump, here's how you can save Hollywood, is a story he would love to read. And like, I guess stepping back, I saw the WGA's statement, and I agree with the sentiment. I understand where they're coming from. But I just look at the last few years, and there's this kind of unaddressed contradiction in how people outside of the streamers have reacted to changes in the industry, which is, on the one hand, you see a lot of the arguments that have a lot of validity, and then the Roy Price arguments about consolidation. And then, on the other hand, these companies are criticized for the ways in which they're damaging the industry, and yet they are spending extraordinary amounts of money on content every year. We are not where the peak was 2 or 3 years ago, but far more money will be spent making scripted television shows this year than, say, 10 years ago, right? So right. There's a like unaddressed conflict here or contradiction here about what's actually happening to the industry. And I don't know if you feel that in talking to people about the ways in which these companies have brought a lot of money in, while at the same time the concentration has unintended consequences.
Yeah. Well, I think you're also getting at why, just from an entertainment industry perspective, there's so much resistance to the Netflix deal in particular, because Hollywood remains an incredibly insular community, and it has never... try as Ted Sarandos has, and he is in many ways like the mayor of Hollywood, but he's never been able to quite take that mantle or position, because Netflix has always been viewed as a little bit of an outsider, right? And you have a lot of people who worked for the various studios who still resent Netflix for the changes that have happened, rather than going, oh, well, maybe we fucked up in like not recognizing what was going to happen and better positioning ourselves. So I think that's definitely where some of it comes from. And to your point about the contradiction, yeah, look, I got a call from a very successful producer late Friday who was like, why is everyone freaking out about the movie business? Netflix doesn't have duplication with Warner Brothers in this area. It will continue to make movies. And by the way, Netflix's movie business has been pretty crappy for the last many years. Them buying a studio that actually makes good movies and putting it on the platform could be a good thing. They were actually more worried about the television business, because Netflix has more kind of overlap there with Warner Brothers, and thought there should be some job losses. But if you are looking at it, Netflix has promised to make a smaller kind of smaller cuts than Paramount has. Netflix says $2 to $3 billion in cuts. Paramount says six. That's a pretty big difference.
How much of that is personal? How much of that is Zaslav just not wanting to do a deal with a Nepo baby?
I think personal egos always matter in this stuff. I mean, like, we like to say it's all about the numbers, and that's where boards make their decision. But the fact that David Zaslav likes Ted Sarandos probably helps him. The fact that, I mean, during the process of the sale, if you're in a room and you sort of got like Ted Sarandos on one side and David Ellison on the other, there's no question that Ted is going to come off as smoother and a little more charming. And that matters. I do think push comes to shove, like, money talks. And so if the Paramount deal were clearly better than the Netflix deal, Warner Brothers would have taken it.
And what happens to CNN and all this? So Netflix doesn't want the cable companies. Ellison was interested in the cable companies, including some kind of a way of putting CNN and CBS together. But if the Netflix deals goes through, that would mean a new company would exist that David Ellison could potentially acquire anyway.
He could, but I don't think he's interested in just... The cable networks are like the tax to get the stuff that he wants. So I don't think that he would go and buy them. Yeah, if the Netflix deal is going to happen, they would spin off CNN and a bunch of other cable networks into a separate asset first, and then the what remains, the studio and streaming, would be acquired by Netflix. Comcast already did a version of this where they spun out a bunch of their cable networks into something called Versant, mm-hmm. which has MS Now, formerly known as MSNBC.
Ms. Now, yeah.
Ms. Now. But so no, I don't think David Ellison would go after. I don't think David Ellison wants CNN. It's like nice to have, but he wants the studio. He wants Warner Brothers Studio. He wants the HBO streaming service. Of all those things, the networks are the third most appealing part.
So that's interesting, because if I've not seen that talked about enough, because I see a lot of people saying how bad this deal would be.
Right.
But I do think there's something
people
troubling.
Are already assuming that Barry Weiss is going to be in charge of the whole thing, and yeah, there's been a lot of.
Well, I just
a lot of concern.
What happens, like, you know, the Netflix deal gets killed. People that have said it should be stopped get what they want. The Ellison deal happens. I do think there's whatever approval problems there could be. It seems clear that, like, because it's smaller, the argument against antitrust is stronger for Warner Brothers and Paramount. And all of a sudden you have Middle Eastern petrostates, to use your words, own a big chunk of not just Warner Brothers, but also CNN.
Right. You know, it's the kind of fact that in almost any other time would likely be disqualifying for a bid. And they even, you know, there was a point at which the Paramount bid had Chinese money in it too.
Yeah, Tencent pulled out like a couple weeks ago, right?
Because Tencent had been an investor in Skydance, David Ellison's initial company. All that stuff would normally be disqualifying, but obviously the current administration has really likes the relationships in the Gulf region. Jared Kushner does a lot of business in that area, and they don't seem too concerned about the presence of Middle Eastern money in the bid. I've certainly spoken with people who are, that doesn't seem like something that President Trump is going to kill a deal over.
Well, two great options for a great American company.
What would be your preferred outcome?
Have Kamala Harris
no deal.
Have Kamala Harris give a different answer about why she'll be different than Joe Biden on The Fucking View. My actual feeling about this, I have no idea. I have no idea, but I do feel like post strike, there's a way in which I just constantly feel like the people inside the industry are kind of running behind the ways it's changing and asking it to stop. And I would just say, I don't know what it looks like, but I would be interested in people who really feel passionately about why a deal like this is dangerous to say this deal should be stopped. But if it goes through, here are the things that we would hope an administration trying to save Hollywood would propose. And I would be interested in that conversation, because right now it's, we're at the bus stop with a bindle, and it's like, which terrible ride are we going to take? But I'd be really interested in like what it would look like for someone to come up with creative ideas for what a company with the scale of Netflix could do for, theatrical releases and for bringing more production back to California, New York, the United States. So that to me is what I'm interested in.
Yeah. No, look, I think you have identified something that bothers me a lot in my coverage of the entertainment business, which is that the people who complain about the ways in which the industry have changed are not really offering proactive solutions. They're just sort of trying to make it go back to the way things were, and that never works.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, and it's hard to grapple with, like, there's nuance here. Netflix has made extraordinary movies and shows. Some of the best shows are being made by Apple, a company that was not in this business till a few years ago, right? Like, right. If you need to change the subject over the holidays, you'll say, are you watching Pluribus, right? That's made by the phone company. So, you know, it's just... To me, like I feel like I am long on people talking about how dangerous all this is and short on the practical changes that would recognize that we're not going back.
Yeah.
And could you go find some of those? Can you go talk to some of your people and come back with some of those?
I will work on that. I'll put together some bullet points and get a one-er for the president.
Lucas Shaw, thank you so much for your time. Good to talk to you.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
That's our show for today. Thanks to Lucas Shaw for coming on. Thanks to AI George Washington for lending us his voice. Dan and I will be back with a new show on Friday. Talk to everybody then. If you want to listen to Pod Save America ad-free and get access to exclusive podcasts, go to crooked.com/friends to subscribe on Supercast, Substack, YouTube, or Apple Podcasts. Also, please consider leaving us a review. That helps boost this episode and everything we do here at Crooked. Pod Save America is a Crooked Media production. Our producers are David Toledo, Emma Illich Frank, and Saul Rubin. Our associate producer is Farah Safari. Austin Fisher is our senior producer. Reed Cherlin is our executive editor. Adrian Hill is our head of news and politics. The show is mixed and edited by Andrew Chadwick. Jordan Cantor is our sound engineer, with audio support from Kyle Seglin and Charlotte Landis. Matt DeGroat is our head of production. Naomi Sengel is our executive assistant. Thanks to our digital team, Elijah Cohn, Haley Jones, Ben Hefcoat, Mia Kelman, Kirill Pelaviv, David Tolles, and Ryan Young. Our production staff is proudly unionized with the Writers Guild of America East.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on two purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.